In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about diversity in higher education. All across the country, colleges and universities, for some years now, have been working on this issue, trying to develop the diversity of their student bodies and also their faculties, with the idea that it's good for the university and it's good for the students. There has been, though, some question perhaps raised by about this very question, that is, well, do we really know for sure that that is the case? Is it really good for students and for the university? And being in education, we do like to have research to confirm these sorts of things. So we'll be talking this morning with Silvia Hurtado. She is Associate Professor and Director of the Center for the Study of Higher and Post-Secondary Education at University of Michigan, and has written a lot. She's published articles and research reports on these very things, the things that she's interested in, educational outcomes, campus climates, diverse students in higher education. In fact, she's one of the authors of a report that came out a couple of years ago, Enacting Diverse Learning Environments, published by Josie Bass, something that I'm sure would be of interest to teachers and educational administrators. She's here visiting the campus to talk with people here about this very subject, and we're glad to have her here to spend some time with us. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And at any point, you're certainly welcome to join the conversation. All we ask of callers is people try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
To begin, I think maybe we could just talk a little bit about numbers and what I think in the trade would be known as structural diversity.
Yes.
Just that very question of, well, how are we doing?
Yes.
And when you look at student populations in higher education now, what sort of makeup do you see?
Well, I think that over time we have made progress. And some institutions are actually still struggling with this issue, depending on their location, what their opportunities are in terms of academic programs. I mean, students really want to come for quality programs. I think that's one thing, and that's true regardless of minority or majority students. They really are looking for quality programs. So I think that's sort of the main piece of that. The other thing that institutions struggle is, you know, their location. Are they near urban areas? Are the schools good in the areas? But in terms of what higher education can do, I think it can do quite a bit in terms of improving the pipeline from K through 12 into higher education in various ways. And of course, higher education is doing that in terms of training of teachers and working with schools. but for the most part, you know, that kind of recruitment idea of increasing the numbers, so to speak, on campus has been only the first step in what needs to happen on a campus in terms of diversity. And I think campuses, although that's still a struggle, it's still an important area to focus on, I think the issue that most of the institutions now are turning to, you know, across the country, are what do we do when everyone arrives on campus? Given that students are coming from predominantly segregated high schools, I mean, historically this has been documented to been taking a turn for the worse, according to Gary Orfield's work. And so then if you bring different people on campus and they don't have any prior scripts, so to speak, on how to interact with each other, and of course we have a history of difficulty with race relations in this country, and some particular communities have even more difficult ones, what do we do when they come on campus? I think that's what we tried to do in the book. It was really address, once the numbers arrive, what do you do next?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you then sort of another number question, and that has to do with retention, and because, as you say, you want to go beyond the fact that simply you enroll more students from different backgrounds. You also hope that their experience in college will be a good one and that they will graduate. Has that indeed been a problem? That is, we get minority students in, but that they don't stay?
Well, yeah, and there's a variety of reasons for that. And I think one of the things that we pointed to, retention certainly, I mean, the academic background or abilities of students is a key thing in retention. But beyond that, we're finding that students of even good academic ability are, from all predictions in the admissions process, should do well at the institution, do not stay. So that was sort of another reason for the book, essentially, was to address issues of the climate of the institution. in the past, I think people have thought of this climate as sort of like the weather. It sort of like kind of affects us all, but we're not really exactly sure how. And I think precisely what we wanted to do with the book was really bring to bear all the research that has been conducted on institutional racial climates and their impact on students, to understand then the reasons why students actually might be leaving, the reasons they may even graduate from an institution and not feel any strong attachment to it. So there's a number of things that educators have faced, and a lot of it has to do with the isolating experiences of some of the minorities on campus.
Yeah. Well, to extend the climate, maybe to abuse the climate metaphor, there is the old saying about how people talk about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Well, I think it's sort of the same thing. I mean, in the sense that we do talk about campus climates and about the fact that diversity is important. We want everyone to feel welcome and at home. And yet it seems that then when we say, okay, what do we do to try to create a positive climate? Then sometimes we say, well, we're really not sure. And I'm sure that it happens in colleges and universities all around the country. You have people of goodwill who say, yes, campus climate, it is important. And then they have to say, well, all right, so what do we do about it?
I think that the basic notion has been initially that if you bring people who are different together, that they'll interact. Well, we know that that's not the case. And so I think as educational institutions, we can be very intentional about what we want to achieve in terms of diversity and learning on campus. And in fact, what we're finding in some of the social science research that's coming out now with some of the lawsuits in terms of the affirmative action cases, we're really finding that there's a strong link between diversity and learning, and how individuals begin to develop a more complex way of thinking from the interactions with diverse others. And our main thesis as part of that book and also of some of the work coming out now is that institutions have to be intentional about those interactions. And I think for the past, as I said, in the past, we sort of let people, if they interacted or not, that would be fine. But now we're thinking about how do we structure ways of learning and learning together as a community that would be important for participation in democracy in the future? How do we want people to engage? How do we want them to experience deliberative kinds of democracy, and that would intake, that actually takes into account differences and different perspectives, and how do you negotiate those things? Those are essential things. Higher education historically has been involved in development of citizens for society. And I think at a certain level, we have a responsibility to take charge of beginning to shape the society we aspire to become in the future. And so college campuses really, for many of those students, represent the first opportunity to encounter someone from a very different background and encounter each other in a very deep way in terms of understanding, not from a theoretical or even historical, whatever's in a text, but actually from a person's experience. And, you know, campus, the time of college is really a time of experimentation. Mm-hmm. Better that they experiment here in a safe environment, so to speak, where the climate supports that kind of interaction, then we can actually produce the kind of learning we expect that we would like to occur among many of our citizens.
Well, I want to follow up on that, but just for a moment to take a step back, because we know that certainly people, one of the reasons people go to college, I guess, or one of the things that happens is you get lessons in life, and these things happen outside of the classroom, and we think that that's a good thing. However, I guess I'm curious about whether creating this kind of positive climate does indeed have some effect on how people perform in the classroom, mm-hmm. and not just, say, African-American students or Latino students or Asian students, but in fact how everyone performs. Can you draw some sort of relationship between classroom performance and the climate, the racial ethnic climate of the campus?
Absolutely. And it might seem surprising, but actually some of the research we're doing currently is we looked at institutions across the country and also at the University of Michigan in terms of students' interactions with diverse others, people who were from very different backgrounds and were even perceived to have different kinds of value structures, to understand what students learned and what kinds of, over time, over 4 years and over 9 years, we looked at undergraduates to really understand what kinds of things they were learning. And what we found that there was actually much more intellectual skills or more active thinking kinds of indicators that were going on among students who had encountered someone and had a good experiences with interacting with someone who's different. And this gets back to even the very basic cognitive theorists who say a lot of our thinking is really mindless. That is, we rely on scripts and routines. And when we come encounter with something that's unfamiliar and different, we have to abandon those scripts and routines. And guess what? That presents an opportunity for learning. This can happen in the classroom if instructors are intentional about kind of disarming students, removing those scripts so they can be active thinkers. Unfortunately, in higher education, we can't take for granted that students are awake and they're active thinkers when they walk into the classroom because so much of it mitigates against it. We are cognitive misers, so to speak. That is, we try to be, not think. If we don't have to be put as much effort into it, we won't do it. So it obviously, there's some level of discomfort that's involved here. It involves what we call a disequilibrium. Piaget talked about, a toddler and encounters with others really experience this disequilibrium when one can move one from one's own embedded view to then begin adopt the perspective of another. That is the kind of learning and complex thinking we really want our students to acquire, because if we continue to have very complex social problems, and I think one of the main goals of higher education is to produce complex thinkers, people who are committed to the public good, and who can be active participants in our democracy. And so we are seeing these links between learning, democracy, engagement with each other, and engagement with people who are different from each other in the research. It's very exciting, and we're continuing the work now.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Silvia Hurtado. She is Associate Professor and Director of the Center for the Study of Higher and Postsecondary Education at University of Michigan, and has done a lot of writing and research on this very topic, that is diversity in higher education and how that relates to teaching and learning. Questions are welcome. In fact, we have somebody here ready to go. The number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have that toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to start with, line number one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
I really appreciate this speaker, and I have two questions. One is, I'm curious if the researcher has done work on the way that the material is presented and what type of material is presented in the classroom and how that affects the retention of minority students or a diverse population. Mm-hmm. And also, I wonder if she's aware of the situation with the Chief Illini Wick on campus and how having a symbol like Chief Illini Wick also affects diversity on campus and the retention of diverse students. And I'm going to hang up right now, so thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for your question. I think the question really talked about what about the content and the pedagogy in the classroom? How does that affect learning? How does that affect diverse students? Well, we know, for example, in students who actually participated in a curriculum that was diverse, that has covered many peoples and histories, and with a skillful instructor, we found that there was a gain in intellectual skills. There was also gains in commitment to some civic kinds of activities as a result of participation in or actually being exposed to the diversity curriculum. What we found most impactful, though, was that was combined with a pedagogy that allowed students to interact with each other, that it was not simply learn the theory and the history from a kind of a very academic perspective, but also allowed students the opportunity to experiment with each other and interact with each other so that they could understand the real histories and experiences and backgrounds and how they played out in American society. That we found the gains for those students were just tremendous. And we did this in a smaller classroom study after looking at some national data, but certainly much more research needs to be done in this area in terms of impact. Other work by other researchers, even in K-12, as well as higher ed, in terms of variety of content that includes mathematics or other kinds of content, reading and learning at the younger ages, in interactions, in collaborative learning groups with different racial groups, what they found is the overall achievement of all the students in those groups was enhanced. And they developed diverse friendships outside of the learning group, which suggests that a lot of what was learned gets transferred into the daily lives of individuals after they've had an educational experience that is thoughtful, that is intentional, that is that really uses diversity as a tool for learning in the classroom. The second question was regarding the mascot, I believe. I just heard a little bit about this as I was coming onto campus. They're probably what I call, when I talk about the climate of an institution, there's a historical legacy of issues of exclusion and issues of stereotyping and whatnot that every institution has. They have a history of this because higher education was not initially open to various groups and was much more homogeneous in years past. I think what we're seeing today is actually more questioning of that historical legacy to understand how that really impacts the environment. And on a one campus, this is just an example of a different campus, there was just the mere issue of the statues all on campus were of men, of white men, and this was in the South. So both the women, even women faculty and students, and the minority students said, no one represents us here. This history of this institution, how can we feel a part of this institution when this doesn't represent us? Or in the case of perhaps the mascot, might misrepresent us. And so I think it does have an impact on the climate. You might not be able to make a direct connection to learning in that regard, but certainly it is an issue with particular groups, and we would do well to listen what students have to say about some of these issues. Sometimes students really bring out the inconsistencies and contradictions in what we do in our institutions, and we don't really realize it. So it's important for us to listen to them.
In addition to trying to increase diversity of the student body, colleges and universities are also trying to increase the diversity of their faculty. And I wonder whether indeed one can say with some certainty that, again, there is a relationship between faculty diversity and, say, you know, you have between your African-American faculty and how many there are and how African-American students do, and sort of the same with students from other backgrounds. We sort of like to believe that that's important and that there should be a relationship, but do we really know that there is one?
There's a couple of ways in which this can actually be looked at, and there's a lot of different ways to try to understand it. And then there's certainly, as I think, a lot more research that needs to be conducted. But the first way, one of the studies that we did was we looked at various faculty from different racial ethnic backgrounds and the pedagogical styles they were using. What we found is African-American Latino faculty were more likely to use collaborative learning activities in the classroom, as were women faculty. We even tried to control for the discipline because obviously some faculty in certain disciplines teach large courses and all of that. And we found the same relationship that women, African-American, and Latino faculty really tended towards creating much more collaborative learning styles, were less concerned with being the main authority in the classroom, but also giving students, empowering students to actually take control of their education. And so we know that from national data. But of course, people can be trained to change their pedagogical techniques. The question is whether they're willing to. That's another issue. So we know that, first of all, that there are differences in teaching styles with some of the so-called underrepresented groups in terms of faculty. The second thing is the idea of modeling, role modeling. And I think it becomes very important for students at the young ages, but also, for example, in graduate school, to be able to be taught, and I've heard many stories for the first time by someone from your own ethnic background, gives you a sense that you are not the one and only, that that you have others who have kind of paved the way or been pioneers in this area, and can begin to model the kind of professional things that occur. And we know historically, in terms of selection committees, in terms of mentoring of students, that people try to mentor people who are like them, not people who are unlike them. That is, they adopt someone who's bright, but also who is somewhat like them. And I think that that's not the case in every In every case, obviously, because we have many people who've been mentored by white faculty and have done a fine job and are doing really well. And in fact, some of our best faculty on campuses now have had those mentors. But it is important in terms of role modeling. Now, we haven't done a thorough study, at least I haven't. It's not my area of work, but it certainly is an area that we've seen play out in graduate programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly I think that there'll be no argument that students have different learning styles. Particularly, it's true. This is something that we talk about, I think, in elementary education. And I'm not, by the way, suggesting that somehow lines up with ethnicity or race. It's
no.
Just that students have different learning styles, and so teachers in the classroom begin to learn that you needed to work with different students in different ways, and what will work with one student won't with another. Though I guess by the time you get to college, is that something that faculty still have to keep in mind, that students even at that age are going to have different learning styles?
Oh, absolutely. Even in mathematics, I've had conversations with the faculty here in mathematics and across the country, and they really are employing a variety of learning styles, including asking students to give presentations, asking students to do writing, asking students to work in small groups, and then listen to what students are able to grasp in terms of the concepts. I think even in, as I think, kind of the hard sciences or areas like mathematics, we're seeing how good faculty members in terms of being conscious of understanding what students learn and whether they get it, whether they get the concepts and can master them before moving on to the next course, are really providing students various opportunities to show their comprehension, to show that they understand, and then they can subsequently communicate their learning to others. So I think this is a very general principle that applies well in higher education as well as K through 12 in terms of really giving students a variety of opportunities to learn almost the same kind of concepts so that it's reinforced, but also giving opportunities to demonstrate their learning in multiple ways.
Mm-hmm. We're just about our midpoint here, and I want to reintroduce our guest. But before I do that, I just do very, very quickly want to do one other thing and just mention that for people who might have been thinking about becoming a financial supporter of the station, you might think about doing that today and taking part in something that we've never really done this before as a sort of a one-day deal, encouraging people to pledge online. But it is possible. We're calling it Cyber Day. And if you do have internet access, it's quick, it's easy. You do help support your favorite programs. You can go to our website and do that. It'll tell you everything that you need to know. We're at WILL.UIUC.EDU, and we would appreciate that very much. Throughout the day, we'll sort of let you know how we're doing. And, of course, you can listen 24 hours a day through the web. And we also have archives of past programs there, so you might catch up on some that you had missed first time around. Again, it's WILL.UIUC.EDU. And our guest in this part of Focus 580, Sylvia Hurtado, is Associate Professor and Director of the Center for the Study of Higher and Postsecondary Education at University of Michigan, and is particularly interested in her research in this issue of diversity in higher education and how that relates to learning and teaching. And she was here to talk with folks on this campus on this very topic and was good enough to come spend some time with us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Just I want to get back to something that you touched on a little while ago, and that is what colleges, universities can do in way of creating a climate that makes it possible for students to have greater, more positive interaction. What happens in the classroom is sort of one thing, and it's easy to see that you'd have a little bit more control over what happens in the classroom. But a lot of what students do, a lot of the time they spend, it's outside of the classroom. It may be in other university-supported activities. It may be in activities that don't really have anything to do with the university. And that, to me, seems a more difficult area to get into. What can university administrations do to foster this kind of atmosphere outside of the classroom?
I think that's a good question because more generally, I think from the very beginning as in terms of the mission and goals of what the institution would like to accomplish, the kinds of students they'd like to produce, the leaders they would like to produce for diverse communities. Certainly that's an issue when one considers admitting a student, is really thinking about how this person is going to be an important contributor to the state and to, you know, the nation in a sense for public institutions. And so I think one of the basic things, and almost all institutions have some kind of diversity goals, but the question is this really central to the educational mission of the institution? I think that's where it has to begin. Understanding that diversity is an important tool for learning. And in fact, I did college admissions in my earlier career before our faculty. And one of the things we really thought about as we were admitting each student was really thinking about how they would contribute to their own communities in terms of where they came from and areas that were diverse and remote, so to speak. And also then what contributions would they make to the environment on campus? And one of the things that we found subsequently, and this was our general notion as educators and administrators, we have this general notion that the peer environment has an impact on students. Well, guess what? We found from the research that time after time, various studies from a number of researchers, renowned researchers in higher education, have really shown that the peer environment has a powerful impact on students' values, altruism, what they learn, how they learn it. Students get their learning skills from other students. Faculty don't tell them precisely how to study. So they're actually learning quite a bit from their peers about the world, about how to succeed in college, as well as how to become a citizen in the future. And we have to begin to realize that peer environment is shaped by us, because we're bringing together people in a community. We help provide the context in the community for people to come together. And I think, for example, in terms of student affairs activities and other activities outside of the classroom or even working with classroom instruction in some of the very important activities like service learning, for example, all of those can be intentionally created or structured so that we realize that we're using the peer environment to its best learning end, that is. Very often you'll hear about the negative effects of peer environments in terms of drinking, in terms of poor grades, in terms of reinforcing all of what we think is very difficult in a campus community, but also difficult in the outside world. And we really have to think about if peers are learning quite a bit from each other, we've got to get a handle on that as educators in order to improve that. And in fact, many student affairs practitioners, as well as even educators, have thought and have begun to use peers to help educate students about everything from sexuality to safe sex to how to learn. And in fact, this at University of Illinois, they also have an intergroup dialogue program. They're using peer facilitators as the powerful force for getting students to talk to each other about racial issues, to break down stereotypes, and hopefully eventually build coalitions around some common goals. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of intentional educational programs really allow students to, or actually administrators, to use students to the best ends, to understand that the peer environment is there, it's there to stay, they've created it. How to use this as a tool for learning, that's what we should be actually thinking about. And I think many, as I said, there are many successful programs that are using peers in that way.
Yeah. Well, that's encouraging because it seems to me that within the last decade or so, that I have heard a lot of people say that they're really concerned about people on college campuses organizing socially and politically around their racial ethnic identity, and in many cases having difficulties, or maybe there being unwillingness to get involved with other people, that there was a real sort of feeling that says, you and I, if we come from the same background, we know each other's experiences, but that other person over there, if they come from someplace else, they don't know what my experience is about, and I'm not, it's not even going to be possible for me to try to relate that to the person. So why do we even bother? That is, you know, our concerns are ours, their concerns are theirs, and we're going to work separately for our concerns. And I think that there was this real worry that students, groups, various groups of students were isolating themselves from each other. And that was something maybe we needed to address.
Well, there's a couple of things that are happening there. First of all, remember I talked about the familiarity, the scripts that we follow. When a student is new and comes onto campus, guess what? They're going to cling to what's familiar to them because everything else is so unfamiliar. And this is sort of a basic human kind of reaction. And we forget what it is to be 17 or 18 to come to a college campus, a huge environment, to try to make sense of that. So the first thing that students would cling to would be people who are from the same high school, the same neighborhood, or who look like them, or who might share the same values, have the same interest in sports, have the same interests in, you know, sailing, whatever that might be, because that is what's familiar to them. And so in some ways, when I talk about intergroup relations or cross-group contact and fostering that, we are kind of working a little bit against some of those natural tendencies of that unfamiliarity. But I said, as educators, we really have to put students in positions of being in and dealing with unfamiliar situations and people, because that's going to happen the rest of their lives. It's very difficult for people to be isolated all of their lives. The other part is students are developing academic skills, they're developing intellectually, but they're also developing their identity. They don't know who they are, David, when they first come, and they want to find out more about that. And they want to find out more about their history and why are they living on one side of town and other people are? Why do more people have cars and big houses and others don't? I mean, they're trying to understand where they come from and what that all means. And so it's a clear search for identity, I think. When groups come together, a lot of what they're doing is identity formation and reaffirmation about who they are. And they're wanting to come to learn more about who they are when they come to campus. So that's why we have different groups. We also have probably a misperception, and this is some research I actually did in looking at various racial ethnic groups and minority students in particular. Any person who's a minority or the only African-American female in a classroom, for example, and then let's say they go to lunch with other black females. Well, guess what? When they're in the classroom, they're always interacting across race. So some part or some time in the day, they want to come together with others who are like them because it gets back to the reaffirmation of who they are and what they do. And so the general notion is those people over there are self-segregating, when in fact, we really have to look at the majority and find out who's not interacting with who. And who, you know, when you look at the probabilities, anybody who's a minority, you know, has to interact with the white majority because that they are the majority. I mean, it's a law of, you know, it's mathematical. It's not even, you know, social. And so I think that we forget that. We forget that some of this is taxing on individuals who are the one and only, the one and only female, the one and only black female in a classroom, in a organization, in higher education. And we have to know that there have to be moments where they do retire to places where they are familiar with others and they can get that affirmation. So we've come a long way, I think, in understanding more about different people's experiences on campus, as opposed to just sort of labeling as this is happening, this is wrong, and it's not the right way to go. But we're really understanding there's a huge complex piece here that's student developing within groups that are part of society, that are part of the social networks on campus, and understanding how to build commonalities across those, build those bridges across those groups. That's part of what we should be doing in the educational environment.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of callers here to talk with, so let's do that, starting with someone on our toll-free line, our line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to say as a Latino that I've come to the conclusion that one of the real problems are the people that are in administrations, not just at the higher education, not just in universities and colleges, but also at the high school level where people get socialized. I have two questions. Has anybody studied the carryover of the effect high school had as far as socialization, if that's a concept that can be studied. And I've got another question, but I think I'll hold on.
Okay.
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of research. If you're talking about socialization in terms of racial ethnic issues, there's been quite a bit of study in terms of students who attended desegregated schools versus those who did not, who attended less diverse schools, for example, and found very different effects in terms of a whole range of long-term outcomes. So we know that, for example, attending a more integrated environment and that being positive for individuals like Latinos, like African Americans, as well as for white students, later results in later opportunities for additional educational opportunities that are more integrated, and also then selecting residences or workplaces that are more diverse. So we are seeing the long-term effects. In fact, some of that research was done by faculty here at the University of Illinois.
And the other thing I was thinking of when you were talking, describing the experience of Latinos or other minorities in universities being put down in such an odd environment to them, is that just like every other student that's there, they looked for validation of what they've come to believe is, quote, the truth or reality or whatever, and this may happen for people from middle class, kids from middle class situations, may happen for kids in upper class situations, but it doesn't happen very well for kids who come from rough backgrounds. They come in there and they see, if anything, a disaffirmation of what they've come to know is fact, and that tends to poison the ground for them. You know, they would love to think that college is a place where they're finally going to be able to ferret out the truth, but instead they find that, and I think in large part because of the influence of administrators and the lack of diversity in that particular group, they find no affirmation of what they know to be true. And that tends to turn them off, and that, to me, is one of the reasons why so few finish. If you could talk to that, and I'll get off. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
That issue really has a lot to do, and several sociologists have talked about the having the social capital, that is, knowing how things work, knowing the cultural norms in a society, and then, or coming from a low-income background, maybe a racial, ethnic, segregated neighborhood, and then coming into a really different cultural context. It is really like landing on another planet for some of these students. And that, in fact, that was my experience when I first went to college. I think one of the things that we're learning, and there's been great research now about something that's called resilience, is that individuals, we have to make sure that we give individuals or strengthen them or make sure that they have the support they need. But there's an awful lot of resilience out there. That is, humans are adaptable. And even though it might be difficult to overcome the difficulties of a low-income background and not knowing even the use of some very simple kinds of things that peers in a college might take for granted, or having even different value structures, I think that they are actually adaptable if they're bright, and typically they are very bright. It's a matter of learning the culture, and we have to say that most of these individuals are quite adaptable, because if they can tolerate a very harsh environment and a hostile climate, then they're that much stronger. I'm not saying that we should make it difficult for them. I'm saying that we have to give them credit for some of the resilience that these individuals have, and then also provide them opportunities so that it's isn't always a struggle to learn or to understand what's happening within both a social environment or even an academic environment. So we do have to provide the supportive structures.
We have another caller. Next, it's line number one. Hello.
Yes, you might consider me a fossil or a dying dinosaur, but the other day we had a process of beginning a meeting to hire new faculty members. And I came into that with the old precepts that we should try to find the best person for the job, academically, teacher evaluations, publications, etc., etc. One of my younger colleagues, this is, I think, perhaps, as I say, a generational thing, maintains that we should look at women, at because the department is obviously overly moved towards the male breed, and he maintains that because of that, that we should just seriously consider only a woman, or basically a woman. And I was shocked by that, and I shouldn't be shocked, because I think it is the new wave for this idea of diversity gone mad. And I just wondered, in your dealings, would you find that offensive when somebody says, no, let's don't look at this qualification or this teaching experience, because these are males, or these are whites, or these are non-Latinos, or whatever the heck it might be, but we should center on the fact that we should hire, because of percentages, a black, Latino, female woman, or whatever that might be. Don't you find that somewhat offensive and academically a nullity?
Well, I would have to say that for the most part, it's kind of a both and. It's not an either or situation. That is, there are lots of talented and excellent women, and also people from different racial ethnic groups. The issue is, what's your overall goal in the department? I know that, in fact, more recently, national accreditation associations have really called departments on the carpet and said, how do you expect to train more undergraduate women, for example, in sciences, if you don't have any role models in your faculty? So I don't think it's diversity gone mad. I think it's really understanding that talent can be found in many other places than we've previously looked. We tend to look, when we do hires, in all the usual places. We don't look for the unusual person who's going to add something additional to our faculty. And I think when we think about faculty hires, we have to think of, certainly, is this person going to be strong enough to sustain the reputation of our department? I mean, I think our standards are quite high in terms of that, in all departments, really. I don't think that it would go either. It wouldn't go any other way. But many campuses have been able to achieve diversity and excellence. The best campuses in the country, there are models, and their departments have been able to achieve both. So I think that probably your department can do the same.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have about 5 minutes left here. Let me just introduce another sort of wrinkle. One of the things we certainly know about higher education is that over time the cost continues to go up, and I don't think that we're expecting that trend is going to turn around. That every year the cost of tuition is going to keep going up. How does that complicate this matter of trying to recruit and retain minority students? Does that, in fact, make it more difficult, that it gets more expensive every year?
It does, and this is not my area of research, but there are many people within our center at University of Michigan that actually do this research and do understand a relationship between rising costs and dropping minority enrollments. They've looked at this. In fact, the person's name is Don Heller, if anybody wants to look at his recent book on the states on accountability by Johns Hopkins Press, that also talks about affordability in higher education. And so the affordability issue is very key, and in fact, many of the campuses that I visit more recently are thinking about, they're providing their own, getting alumni to fund their own fellowships so they can provide that extra bit of monies to attract the best students. And so, yeah, the best students are being bought. There's lots of money being thrown around at the best students in competition for those. So, yes, that's exactly true. And we always have to be vigilant in terms of whether or not the financial aid system can keep pace with these rising costs. So it is a concern nationally. It is a concern to institutions in particular who may or may not know until they've actually looked at the data over time at their own institution to really see how that has affected enrollments. But we have seen nationally over time a real drop in low-income students deciding to go to particular colleges as a result, and that's been documented in public policy studies.
Try and squeeze one more caller here, at least. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
With regard to this faculty hiring business, it seems to me that in academia as well as in all kinds of other things, that there's a temptation to judge people solely on the quantity of work that they produce. I mean, not solely, but I can see that there are people who don't have a life and who do only this and who sacrifice families, their children, their spouses. Do you really want to consider those people as the best kind of people to be mentoring and dealing with students? That may not be the case in terms of somebody who produces a lot of stuff, but I think that one should not simply have those kinds of things as criteria, number of papers, number of books, and so forth. It seems to me that life experiences, the humanness of the person, what they can bring to the teaching, all ought to be considered. And what you're talking about here produces role models for people.
Mm-hmm.
One shouldn't say that somebody who is sloppy academically should be hired, but I think one needs to broaden the definition of what makes a good faculty member and what, as you said, what contributes to the department. You don't want students to think that somebody of a certain type can't possibly do math because they've never seen that kind of a person as a faculty member somewhere, where they may be able to do very interesting math, and maybe it breaks the mold and comes out in some different ways,
mm-hmm.
or stimulates students in interesting ways because that person is not the rigid academician type of person. Now, I'm not an academic, but I've been watching some of this for quite a few years,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're really almost at the end of the time. I want to give the guest a chance to make a comment.
Just briefly, I think that it's true that some institutions have begun to open up the conversation about the ways that individuals are evaluated for promotion and tenure and for merit purposes. And one of the central questions that any department will ask is, does this person have impact? And sometimes what we do is we're too quick to use the easy ways of measuring impact, that is, number of articles. But I think if you look more closely, I think those that are the best institutions in the country are now looking at how powerful is this piece, how powerful is this person in the classroom, and they're beginning to identify ways of measuring that, of gaining a sense of the person's impact. And that's what any department would want, any institution would want, is just have impact on the field.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to stop there with our thanks to our guest, Sylvia Hurtado. Thank you very much for being here.
Welcome.
She is director of the Center for the Study of Higher and Post-Secondary Education at University of Michigan.